From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman. You're listening to Good Food.
It's hard to make a croissant. It takes 3 days to make a croissant. You can make a human in that bathroom. You cannot make a croissant in that bathroom. Like, how many people here have successfully made a croissant? How many people here have accidentally made a human? And those two people are never the same because croissant makers are planners.
Michelle Wolfe is not joking. Croissants are hard. Just ask aerospace engineer turned baker Kate Reed. She was a successful Formula One engineer who designed race cars before she turned her eye to viennoiserie. With a high-octane career, she'd blow off steam by baking until one day she realized that she wanted to change lanes and steer her life in a different direction. Kate operates the celebrated bakery Lune Croissanterie in Melbourne, Australia, and her croissants rival those made anywhere in France. Her new book is Lune, Croissants All Day, All Night. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Evan. I am not sure I've heard someone pronounce croissanterie quite as beautifully as you did. Thank you so much.
I practiced. So share a little bit about your beginnings and how you ended up designing race cars. Your story is really one of the greatest.
Oh, thank you so much. I think my love of motor racing, but in particular Formula One, started off from a very young age. I'm really close to my dad. We've been best mates our whole life. And for me, dad had loved motor racing since before I was born. And it felt natural to me that us hanging out was probably sitting on the couch watching the Formula One races as they traveled around the world. But it wasn't until 1996 that the Grand Prix moved from Adelaide, which is in a different part of Australia to where I live, to Melbourne. And for the first time ever, I think I was about 13 years old, dad bought myself and my brother a ticket to one of the practice days and took us along to the track. And it was the first time that I'd seen a Formula One car for real. And maybe I should say heard a Formula One car for real, because that happened before I saw it. And I just remember being so awe-inspired by this crazy technology that enabled a car to travel at what appeared to 13-year-old me light speed, that I knew in that moment that my life had to be involved in the Formula One industry.
So, I mean, this is an amazing career. You're getting to do something that you've wanted to do your whole life. And then what happens? You're in France and you have a life-changing croissant?
No, actually, I think the story is slightly darker than that. And I hope you don't mind me going down this rabbit hole. But as you said, I'd worked, you know, up until that point my entire life to get into Formula One. And that kind of represents about a decade of focusing on the maths and sciences at school, going to university and getting an aerospace engineering degree, and at the same time trying to get experience in like lower classes of motorsport to make myself more desirable to the Formula One teams. So 23 years old, I finally end up with my dream job at the Williams F1 team. And I think teenagers can be pretty imaginative, and I was no exception to that. So at 13 years old, I painted a pretty probably unrealistic picture of what it looked like to work as an engineer in a Formula One team. And I think the reality when I finally got there was quite different to that picture that I had painted. So, you know, it would have been helpful. Like, I think it would be helpful for all kids to understand what the reality of workplaces are. But I'm a chatterbox. I love collaborating with people. I love working with my hands and being in a really dynamic environment. But when I finally got into F1, the team that I was working at was definitely mid-pack, so not leading the races. And I think because there's just so much money behind Formula One and the expectation to be at the front and to be winning, a lot of pressure is applied on everyone working in the teams to put all of their energy and effort into making the team get closer to the front of the pack. So we were working stupidly long hours. I mean, you know, 16, 18 hours a day, typically in front of a computer. We were discouraged from conversation in the office. And, you know, the things that I told you that make me feel really great that I love in a job, I wasn't actually getting that stimulation. And I was like, okay, I've got to earn my stripes. So I worked pretty hard in the first year and I actually moved to another team after a year thinking maybe it'll be different if I move to another team, but it was actually worse at the second team. And I think the reality started to set in that the environment wasn't really conducive to making me happy. So I developed depression and then actually an eating disorder. It wasn't because I had bad body image issues. It was purely because many aspects of my life were out of control and inadvertently I started to control the two things that I could, which was eating and exercise. And ironically, at the same time, my only moment of happiness in the day was deciding throughout the day at work what I would bake when I went home. And I'd take it into the office the next day and I would see how much joy, even just for 10 minutes at morning tea, that it would bring everyone in the office. And ironically, that was the thing that would sort of make everybody come together and stop their work and put a smile on everyone's faces. So I was getting this joy from the baking and then also from seeing how happy it made everybody. I hope you don't mind me sharing all of that with you.
Oh, no, we love it. Are you kidding? It's so important for young women to hear these kinds of stories. I appreciate you sharing it.
Oh, I really think so too. And just to touch on that, there's still a bit of a taboo around eating disorders. And I think if we talk about it more and normalize the sharing of stories of recovery, people that are suffering from it out there can see that there is life and hope beyond an eating disorder. And it's not something that you should hide away from. It's something that support needs to be improved in the area and that wonderful things can come beyond that.
I'm curious, your first experience with actually making croissants, did it happen within the context of a class or did you just teach yourself?
No. So when I finally came back from Melbourne after my few years in Formula One, I did decide that I wanted to pursue baking, but I got jobs at little cafes baking fairly simple things like cakes and tarts and biscuits. But after a period of time, I was getting a little bit not bored, but not challenged by the easier recipes. And I'd started to do some investigation about French pastry. And I ended up buying a book on Amazon called Paris Patisseries, History and Recipes. And it's this beautiful coffee table book. And I came home from work one day and it had arrived. And it kind of sounds like I'm making this up, but it's no word of a lie. I sat down on the floor of my lounge room and randomly opened the book. And the page that I opened to was this double page spread of a photo of pain au chocolat or chocolatine, chocolate croissants. And they were all piled up on each other. And it was a real macro photo where you could see the beautiful lamination and detail in every single pastry. And I was so enamored by this, like not just wanting to reach into the page and eat it, but also the technicality that it took to produce those pastries, that I closed the book, walked to the nearest travel agent and booked myself a ticket to Paris. And a few months later, found myself in Paris and I wanted to go to the bakery where I'd seen the photo taken. So walked in, told them the story. They gave me a whole lot of free pastries. I was so enamored by the experience that the next day I emailed the bakery and I said, oh, look, you just gave me this incredible experience. I don't suppose you would ever consider taking me on as an apprentice. And the bakery owner wrote back to me very quickly and he said, look, you don't speak French. We're a very small bakery. We normally wouldn't, but I can see the same passion and motivation in you that is in me. When do you want to start? So my first experience of making croissants was actually in the best boulangerie in Paris, which is, yeah, like
that's I crazy.
Pinch myself.
What a
it's crazy,
crazy story.
And I worked in the bakery for a month doing a stage, which is an unpaid internship. And I feel like I just lived in a movie for a month. Not that the actual work wasn't glamorous. It was incredibly physically challenging. I was learning this brand new craft in a language that I didn't speak. So I had to be so visual in learning and watching what was happening. I'd never been so fulfilled and stimulated by work in my life. So for me, that month in Paris really solidified the fact that I'd picked the right path to follow. And in particular, croissants just captured my imagination because not only are they so delicious, they're so incredibly difficult and technical to make. So that was like hitting off all the markers for me of, you know, an aerospace engineer needing something technical that challenged them.
So talk about how you end up back home, you're back in Melbourne, and you're kind of are reverse engineering what you learned in France so you could produce it there.
So when I came back from Paris, I thought, I'm going to try making croissants at home. Like, surely I know everything there is to know about croissants. I've worked in a bakery in Paris for a month. So I bought a couple of books that had recipes for the home baker in them. And the two times I tried it, they were complete disasters. And I was a bit surprised, but when I was sort of reading through the recipe, I wasn't sure if the dough felt right. It felt a bit crumbly and dry, and maybe it felt a bit too cold to work, and I was struggling with the butter, and they definitely didn't come out of the oven like the ones had in Paris. So interestingly, on the back of those two tests at home, I decided to open a bakery that specialized only in croissants, which I think some people thought that I was completely crazy.
You're just the greatest. I love this story so much.
So I quit my job. I signed a lease on a tiny little shop. I spent my life savings on bakery equipment. And it's important to note that my job in Paris, considering I'd only been there for a month, my job had been to make the croissant dough. So I was excited the first day that the bakery was like ready to go and I could start my testing. I made the dough. I pulled it out of the fridge the next day. And I remember looking at it on the bench and thinking, oh my God, I've actually got no idea what to do next. I don't know how to use this bit of equipment that's a laminator. I don't know how to create the layers in the croissants. I don't know how to proof them. I don't know how to bake them. It's like, maybe I know 10% of what I need to know. So yes, when you say reverse engineered, I'd already established a business. I couldn't really afford to leave that behind and go back to school or do an apprenticeship. So I thought, well, okay, I'm an engineer and it's not like I'm going to put a croissant in a wind tunnel and test its, you know, its aerodynamic properties, but maybe I can use engineering process to figure out how to make these. So I imagined what my perfect end product would look like. And then I sort of started with a base level idea of how I needed to do it. And then every day I just changed one variable at a time. And over the course of about 3 months, I ended up on a process that gave me what my perfect end product, what I dreamt about. So yeah, I reverse engineered the way to make croissants. But because I did that, I ended up on a process that's very, very different to the classic French way of making them. Yet you end up with a beautiful French croissant at the end of it.
So you went through this reverse engineering process as you opened your business, and now you're confronted with writing a book for the home cook. So I'm just imagining that requires a completely different set of engineering problems. So how does the Lune croissant differ from the recipe in Lune the cookbook?
Well, I think I described those two experiences that I had at home trying to make croissants from books for the home cook. And I think when I embarked on writing the book, and it took me 9 years from founding Lune to deciding to write a cookbook. I mean, I've been approached many times in the past few years, but 9 years in, I thought, okay, there's enough history behind Lune to write about the story of Lune. We've got a great collection of recipes that we've developed over the years. And I also feel like maybe I'm ready to tackle that, trying to figure out how to make it at home, because there was definitely PTSD from those two experiences prior to starting Lune. So I had some ideas about how I could change laminating the butter into the dough, which in a commercial bakery, you have a piece of equipment called a laminator, which really gently and consistently rolls out your dough and butter to allow you to get it thin enough to fold it again and roll it out and create those multiple layers. But at home, nobody has a laminator. It's like a huge piece of equipment and the equivalent that we have in our home kitchens is a rolling pin. And when humans use a rolling pin to roll out dough, we impart a lot more strength into the dough than a laminator does, which means the gluten bonds strengthen. And as you're trying to roll it out thinner and thinner, those strong gluten bonds pull the dough in and make it want to stay tight. So it's really hard to get it rolled out. And when you're pushing really hard on it, you often break the outer layer of dough and butter pops out and you have to sprinkle flour on the bench so your dough's not sticking. And then you've changed your perfect ratio from your recipe and suddenly it's a mess, your layers are bad, you've got more flour than you want and you end up with a really bad product at the end, which is what I experienced when I tried it, you know, before starting Loon. So I had this idea that maybe rather than creating a block of butter that was solid and was laminated in, you could soften the butter, not melt it, but just to spreading consistency. And you could do the work on the dough, getting it rolled out and then apply the butter for the first time, but also laminate the butter in two stages rather than one, which you do in the commercial setting or as we do at Loon. So I was testing out these ideas and they were working to a certain extent, but I was still finding the dough, those gluten bonds in the dough were developing to be too strong. And I really felt like I was beating my head against a brick wall. And finally, I had this realization that I'd been using the dough recipe for Loon. And I thought, well, maybe the problem is actually like for the home baker, we need to have a recipe where more extensibility or the ability to roll out the dough is easier for the home chef. So I actually went back right to the start, back to square one, and I completely wrote the dough recipe from scratch for the home chef as well. So in the book, we create something called a poolish, which is a pre-ferment that's, the poolish is 100% hydration. I'm getting quite technical here, so.
That's good. Continue.
So this poolish is 100% hydration, which means it's the same percentage of water to flour. And when you add that in, when you create your dough, it actually creates a far more extensible dough. And once I trialed this new recipe with the poolish, I then, all the techniques that I was testing out with the differences in laminating the butter into the dough started working perfectly. And the first time I tried it, it worked perfectly. And I thought, okay, well, if I was doing this from an engineering perspective, you can't rely on one test to prove a whole theory. So I tried it several times during that week and each week the result came out perfectly. And I thought to myself, I think I've actually nutted this out. So like once I'd figured out the recipe, you then have to write down what you're doing and actually put that into words for the home chef. And I just decided to leave no detail unspoken. But then after I'd written the recipe, I thought some people don't learn through words. Some people learn visually. So when we were doing the photo shoot for the book, it was really imperative to me that every single step in the process had a photo attached to it. So those people that learn visually could reference the image if the words weren't getting through to them as well.
So Kate, do you have a challenge looming in your brain, something that you haven't been able to perfect yet that is just niggling away at you that you must take on?
I always have things niggling away at my brain that I haven't perfected. There are a couple of pastries that are definitely on my radar that are non-croissant related. One is the sfogliatella, and it's been an obsession of mine for probably coming on 5 years now. But knowing the energy and effort that I had to throw behind the croissant, sometimes I'm a little bit terrified to dip my toe into the water of a new challenging pastry. And also the panettone, which I think is probably one of the most challenging baked goods to make really well in the world.
Given that they are two of my favorite things to consume, that thrills me. This was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Evan. It was just lovely to talk to you.
That's Kate Reed of Loon Croissanterie in Melbourne, Australia. Her first book, Loon Croissant All Day All Night, is available now. Coming up, for my entire life, I've been told that croissants are about butter. So when I heard about an LA baker making vegan croissants that rival their dairy counterparts, I had to learn more. Hear how she does it next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Baking is a science. Baking without butter and eggs is a whole other animal. Take croissant, for example. It's the lamination of butter in the dough that creates the delicate, airy layers of a deep golden croissant. Jennifer Yee is making vegan versions at Baker's Bench in Far East Plaza. She'll also be judging the vegan category of the pie contest, a category where I'm always impressed by entries that can achieve delicious magic sans some of baking's basic ingredients. Hi.
Hi. How are you, Evan?
I'm great. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm happy to be here.
I understand that early in your pastry career, a chef made a passing remark about the impossibility of a plant-based viennoiserie, a challenge that you took heart. How long did it take you to crack the code, as you say?
Honestly, I feel, this is not a brag, but I feel really lucky because for the croissants, not that they're perfect, but I think it took me three tries to get something where I was like, we can do this. This would be great. From there, we're probably on, you know, version 6 or 7, but we're still pretty much in the beginning ballparks. But I would say for our vegan cookies, we're probably on number 50 or something like that. I found those much harder.
Wow, that's so interesting. You've worked for Jean-Georges Van Gerichten and Thomas Keller, and more recently at Combi in Echo Park. Can you talk a bit about the rigors of pastry life and how with Baker's Bench you're trying to do things differently?
I always felt like if I just put in my time and I just worked at the hardest kitchens I could get myself into and just get them on the resume, eventually it will pay off. And I think it took me, I felt like I really had to settle into my role at Baker's Bench and feel really, it took me a personal learning experience to feel like confident and comfortable to where I am, where I can say, you know what, I am going to take time off now and I'm not going to feel bad about it because this is what I've been working for. So I do feel really thankful to be where I am. And I don't ever take that lightly.
Because when you are in one of those really rigorous kitchens, the idea of time off is sort of a fantasy.
Oh my goodness. I think when I was at French Laundry, we were working, if you worked AM, you worked from 6 AM till 6 PM. If you work PM, you work from either noon or 1 PM until 1 a.m. or midnight. And then at Jean-Georges, we would go in later, but sometimes we wouldn't get out until 2 a.m. And then you have to take the subway all the way home at 2 a.m. in New York.
Wow. Could we talk about what butter substitutes you're using at Baker's Bench? Or do you even think about it that way?
I do. For the croissants, I use 2 butter substitutes. I use a brand of butter called Violife, and it's more of like a margarine quality where it's like pretty soft despite the temperature. I use that in the dough. And then for the lock-in part, the part that we laminate, I use a different brand of butter called Fora. Fora has a higher melting point, so it stays plastic and firm for longer. And that really helps me achieve nicer layers in my croissants. For the cookies, we don't even use a butter substitute. I try not to bring too many ingredients into the kitchen that are like vegan substitutes, like a vegan cream cheese or a vegan sour cream. We do use those 2 butters. We do use a vegan cream supplement as a whipped cream. But for the cookies, we don't use an egg substitute or anything like that.
So you said that cookies are actually more of a challenge. Talk to us a bit about that.
Oof, they are. I feel like with croissants, with the dough, there's fat when you lock in, but the dough itself is pretty much just like, in the world of doughs, a dough. Like, it's pretty almost flexible. But with the cookies, you're trying to force so much fat into the flour, which fat and flour don't really take to each other naturally anyways, but you're trying to force so much fat into the flour that sometimes they'll like unemulsify or they'll split, the oil will leach out, there's too much fat in it, they'll just be one large puddle. If there's not enough, they'll be rock hard. It's really a fine line. There's not a lot of versatility when you're coming to the building blocks of it.
Do baking techniques or timings change when you're using plant-based ingredients?
The baking techniques have changed. Obviously, for the cookies, we're not creaming it. We're not creaming butter and sugar and adding eggs. We do something completely different at Baker's Bench. We make a sugar stock. So we take water and sugar, we boil that, we emulsify in oil, and then we add it to flours. It's completely different. It uses my brain in a very different, counterintuitive way to make the vegan pastries. But for the croissants, it's pretty straightforward still. We're making a dough. We're letting it proof. We're locking it in. We're shaping. Everything there is still pretty straightforward as a traditional croissant.
Did you have a mentor for all these vegan processes when it comes to pastry, or did you just dive in as a challenge for yourself?
I wouldn't say I have one mentor. I feel like I have very many encouraging people around me that are much smarter than me that I can bounce ideas off of. Kristen from Colossus Bakery in San Pedro and Long Beach has helped me a lot. Justine from Just What I Needed in Frogtown has helped me a lot. But other than that, I read a lot of Harold McGee on food and cooking. That's what I do.
The famed food scientist.
Yes.
It's a great book to turn to.
Yeah.
If you were to do a blind taste test with your vegan croissant next to a butter croissant that you made, would they be indistinguishable?
No, I feel like a mom can always find her child, you know?
But what about me? Would I be able to tell the difference?
Some people say they can't tell. Some people say they think it's better than a butter croissant. So I would be interested. I think you have a very good and sharp palate, Evan. So maybe you could, but other people can't.
That's so interesting. So interesting. So you're going to be judging the vegan category at this year's KCRW Good Food Pie Fest. What are you looking for in a vegan pie, and what tips can you offer our bakers? It's an interesting category because since the category is vegan, there are many, many different types of pies that arrive within that category. It could be fruit pie, a cream pie, a quote, custard pie.
Yeah, I feel like what I'm looking for in a vegan pie is what I would be looking for in a normal pie, which is something that has a flaky crust. I feel like the crust should be flavorful as well. Nobody wants a bland crust. I'm looking for something that isn't soggy on the bottom. So I want something that's blind baked and sealed well, either with egg wash or whatever, you know, people are choosing to do, soy wash, sugar, chocolate. But I want a really nice, sealed, crispy crust on the bottom. And I want a flavorful filling. Like, vegan food should be good. We should be encouraging people to eat it. It should be tasty and fun and fresh. So I want something that has flavor.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Jen. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jennifer Yee of Baker's Bench in Chinatown. She'll be a judge at KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and contest on April 30th. Do you have what it takes to win a ribbon without using butter? Enter the vegan category and impress Jen along with our other judges, artist Stacy Michelson, Justine Hernandez of Just What I Needed, and Zen Ong of Awan. LA has always been a place where young people dream and work towards success in entertainment while toiling in hospitality venues. I worked as a caterer for a decade, putting myself through school, then supporting myself as I flailed around to find my dream. Ironically, it turned out to be cooking itself. Catering is such an odd profession. You are perennially backstage, which can be frustrating for young people with dreams. The workplace comedy Party Down is a hilarious window into this world. New York Times critic at large Tejal Rao took a look at this inhospitable part of hospitality in an essay for the New York Times. Hi, Tejal.
Hi, Evan.
What is the premise of Party Down for those who have not yet watched it?
Okay, so Party Down is about a group of lovable slackers who all aspire to be writers or actors and who work together at this company called Party Down. And every episode, they are catering a different party in Los Angeles. It might be a rich kid, sweet 16 on a giant boat, or a backstage party for a jaded glam rock superstar. It might be someone's very awkward suburban orgy or a single seminar for seniors. Every episode is a different terrible surprise for them. and none of them really take the job seriously because catering isn't their real life. It's just kind of keeping them afloat until their dreams come true.
I always felt that parties are entertainment adjacent. You have the celebs or writers or even sound engineers who are successfully working in the business rubbing up against these strivers and dreamers. It's just such a perfect setup for awkward encounters.
Yes, and the awkward encounters are sort of nonstop. So much of the comedy is really cringy. You know, there's some kind of disaster. And it's stacked with a lot of great comedians. You know, the show premiered in 2009, and it was canceled after just two seasons, which is very sad. But it had, you know, Adam Scott, Ken Marino, Jane Lynch, Jennifer Coolidge, Martin Starr. One of my favorite episodes has Steve Guttenberg in it. J.K. Simmons appears a few times. Because there's a different party in every episode, there's also this opportunity for guest stars in every episode.
And so now, 13 years later, there's this reboot. And for me, it's almost sad how seamless the reboot is for the characters themselves.
Yeah, it's like, you know, over a decade has passed and a lot of them are still stuck in the same place that they were 13 years ago.
Or even worse, maybe they've had a taste of success, but it hasn't sustained. And so they find themselves back working as a cater waiter.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that was supposed to be their big break did not work out.
What's so interesting about the cast is that the people who are centered are these like kind of slacker ne'er-do-wells. But sometimes even the party givers aren't that far afield in a way from the waiters.
Yeah, and they almost romanticize the lifestyle of the young cater waiter and what it must be like to be this free spirit working from gig to gig, even though in reality that can be very stressful. You know, there's one episode where a wealthy suburban dad is getting a drink in his beautiful home and sighing at Henry, who's the bartender, saying, "Oh, I could have been you, you know? I could have been a cater waiter, but here I am stuck in my boring, boring, cushy life."
And the waiters are just listen to this and take it in. And
yeah.
Oh my God, the takes on the faces are just precious. So since it first aired in 2009, so many food and chef-focused movies and TV shows have aired, mostly looking at the world of hospitality through like a kind of hushed rose-colored lens. Even bad behavior is mythologized.
Yeah, I mean, since 2009, we've seen, you know, Chef's Table and more recently, The Menu, The Bear. There are these shows where even if the work appears difficult, it's still glamorous and everyone is ambitious and competitive. And there's kind of this excitement driving all of the cooking and the service. And Party Down is just absolutely the opposite of all of that. It's so refreshing. It's goofy, but it also doesn't glorify or romanticize the food industry. And right now, that feels very honest.
And nobody working for the company Party Down is committed to their work.
Oh, yeah. No one wants to be there. Everyone would rather be somewhere else.
How do you think that post-pandemic, this particular satire reads?
Yeah, in 2009, the show really felt like a read on Los Angeles and on the catering industry in a smaller way. But now it just feels like a much more honest way of talking about the food industry when we know how difficult it is and how unjust it can be. Having a bunch of, even calling them slackers feels almost unfair. They're in a job that is thankless and difficult and probably doesn't pay them well enough. And we know that the endlessly optimistic and terrible manager is the only person who gets health insurance. So it just feels like a really refreshing and honest take on food service right now.
So much of the internal drama of working food service happens in what you call the liminal spaces, backstage, if you will, taking a smoke in the back in an alley, home kitchens. And these home kitchens and the homes themselves in each episode kind of become characters in a way.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just the liminal spaces. The whole show is also taking place in the in-between time that we tend to dismiss of day-to-day life and of work. But for the characters, it turns out an entire show is happening in this time that's not really supposed to count. The time before their big break that maybe they would compress into a couple of funny stories when they're famous about how they used to work in catering. But that's actually the stuff, that's the good stuff. That's where all the comedy and tragedy of life is. It's sort of in the prep time and the side work and the cutting limes and the lighting chafing dishes. And I think that's sort of the beauty of the show, is that all of that time is meaningful and it does add up to something profound.
Well, thank you so much. This has been so much fun, and I really loved that part of my work this week was just to binge a bunch of Party Down.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
That was critic at large for the New York Times, Tejal Rao, talking about the workplace sitcom Party Down. In a minute, I've always thought gefilte fish has a branding problem. It's just a poached fish croquette. But say gefilte and people make that face. So up next, I've got the fish meatball, dare I say gefilte recipe, that will have you asking for seconds this Passover. Stick around. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. I have to admit I'm a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to holiday menus, so I'm dubious when anyone wants to monkey around with my matzo ball soup. But when you're in food, it pays to expand your horizons. This Passover, I'm turning to Hani Apfelbaum, who, as she raises a family of new eaters, is bringing tried and true recipes into a new millennia, all while remaining totally kosher. Hi, Hani.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're thrilled to have you. Did you grow up in a kosher home?
I did.
And how does your cooking differ from that of your mom and maybe your bubby?
Oh, it's completely a different ballgame. I grew up eating very traditional Ashkenazi Jewish food. My grandmother as well. All the things you can think of, gefilte fish, kugel, brisket, matzo ball soup. All brown foods, by the way. And I like to say about kugel, why boil up a vegetable, take all the flavor out of it, mash it up, add eggs, and make kugel when you could just roast the vegetable with olive oil, So really, I kind of love to bring a little bit more of a healthy approach to food, lighter approach, not so heavy, and very, very colorful.
What are there certain ingredients that you find incredibly useful in your modern kosher pantry that you use beyond like substitutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that like the biggest obstacle for kosher keepers is the fact that we can't mix milk and meat together in the same dish. So, you know, I rely on things like coconut oil, you know, as a replacement for butter in baked goods. I know like old school people used a lot of margarine, and I really like to stay away from that. And coconut oil is a great replacement because it's solid at room temperature. And if you buy refined coconut oil, it doesn't have a coconut flavor. And things like miso that, you know, really bring the umami flavor to, you know, dishes that you want to add cheese to, but you need that flavor of meat that you can't put in the dish. So adding things like portobello mushrooms and miso and soy sauce will bring that umami flavor. And obviously now with all the plant-based meats, that really helps with you know, being able to mix milk and meat together in the same dish, just using impossible beef and things like that. So, I really find that there's so much on the market nowadays that can help us, you know, find a way to be creative so you don't feel restricted in the kosher kitchen.
Yeah, the whole explosion of vegan, quote, dairy products must be incredibly useful.
Definitely. I've never really found like the perfect cheese that has that really cheese pull that you get with real cheese. So like I would prefer to use real dairy and then replace the meat rather than use real meat and replace the dairy.
Really interesting. And I completely understand.
Yeah.
So there's a particular recipe that kind of put your blog Busy in Brooklyn on the map. And it's a recipe for drunken Hasselback salami.
Yes.
You must describe that for us.
Okay, so Hasselback potatoes, for those that don't know, is when you kind of cut the potatoes accordion style. And a great trick for that, by the way, is to put chopsticks on either side so you don't cut all the way through. So it kind of fans out and you get these slices and it's pretty to look at. So I did that with salami and then I made a drunken glaze with you know, jam and mustard and brandy and pour it over and you bake the salami so it gets like all the little crispy bits around the edges. And it is just so delicious. Everyone goes crazy for it.
I love that so much. I wish my mother were still here so I could make that for her. As we prepare for Passover, what can we serve that goes beyond, you know, the traditional matzo ball soup and brisket? How do we honor tradition while making a Seder more contemporary?
So when it comes to like the Seder, I'm, you know, as much as I love making things out of the box and different and modern, when it comes to certain holidays, I really feel like I don't want to mess with tradition. So I really do make a lot of the dishes that my mother made growing up. But some fun things that I did, you know, the hillel sandwich, I always say korach, which is in the Passover Seder, comes right before Shulchan Aruch, which is the festive meal. And by that time, everyone always jokes how we read through the Haggadah and it's so long and everyone's so starving by the time the meal comes. So the thing we do right before Shulchan Aruch is we eat this hillel sandwich, which is lettuce and mar, bitter herbs, and matzah all together, and you dip it in charoset. And, you know, normally nobody would want to eat lettuce, horseradish between two pieces of matzah, but you're so hungry then. Like, I feel like it's the most delicious thing ever. So I made this dish I called matzah rayas, inspired by that because it's kind of messy. A rayas is a Middle Eastern pizza pocket that's stuffed with ground beef, and it's grilled, and it's like a burger on steroids. So delicious. So I took that concept, and I did it between two pieces of matzah. So it's a little bit messy, but it's a super fun dish. So that's kind of like how I put a spin on the hillel sandwich. And I also have some charoset bars in the book, which are gluten-free and kosher for Passover and have that delicious, you know, charoset jam in the middle that you can eat as a breakfast bar or as a dessert. And they're really delicious. So it really kind of pays respect to the nostalgia of those dishes for the holiday, but gives it a little spin.
You know, it's so funny, you know, for all the years that I used to host Passover in my restaurant, and we would make just tubs and tubs and tubs of charoset, and we would always have leftovers. My favorite thing to do with it was to make charoset bars. So I really loved to see
love
yours.
Oh, love that.
But what I really, I would love to talk to you about gefilte fish, because I feel like this is something that gets so maligned, even though all it is like a poached fish croquette. and it appears in many different cuisines sauced. So can you talk about your family's, I understand, somewhat sacred gefilte fish recipe and share the story behind it?
Sure. So first of all, I think gefilte fish is traumatizing for people because they look at gefilte fish as the stuff that's in the jar in with the jelly. And, you know, it's just like that's complete gray mush. And I actually grew up eating that type of gefilte fish. And the Wall Street Journal actually ran an article about gefilte fish years ago. They interviewed me and I said, I still have nightmares. And that was the headline of their article. Because I do think that stuff is absolutely gross. And if anyone thinks that that's gefilte fish, I totally get it. But like you said, gefilte fish is really just ground fish. It's mixed with some onion and carrots. And then you just, you know, you kind of make a croquette out of it and then poach it. And it's delicious. But I, you know, I grew up, we made gefilte fish from scratch every Passover. My parents used to make it. And I actually grew up Chabad. As part of the Chabad Lubavitch movement here in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And my dad used to work in the home of the Lubavitch Rebbe, and he used to make gefilte fish there, you know, throughout the year. It was a recipe from the Rebbe's wife, the Rebbe Simcha Yemushka, that, you know, it was a family recipe of hers, and he used to prepare it there and then would make it with my mom for Passover once a year. You know, they would literally, I remember them like bringing the fish home and scaling it and just like breaking it down. And it's just like a beautiful memory roll. We would all be around the table preparing and helping, you know, peeling the onions and someone was cutting, you know, cutting the carrots. And it was just like a family project. So for me, that's like just one of the really special moments of my childhood. Like it just felt like such a sacred family time. And we would just eat it through the holiday. She would put in a lot of sugar because she was always heavy-handed with the sugar. And I always joke with her, like, sugar is a sweetener, not a seasoning. Because, you know, with the Ashkenazi Hungarian palate, they tend to make things very, very sweet. So she was always, like, throwing more sugar in the pot. But, yeah, I mean, I love that recipe.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I do when I make gefilte fish is I take the sugar out. So tell me about your modern take with curry.
So, look, I'm always putting spins on gefilte because, like you said, there's this stereotype of gefilte fish. So, actually, in my first cookbook, I did this Moroccan fish cake where I took, like, the flavors of Moroccan fish and I mixed them into ground gefilte mixture. And I just used a frozen loaf to make it easier and defrost it and then made that flavorful, delicious tomato sauce. And it really, like, blew people's minds because, you know, I always like to joke the Ashkenazi palate is paprika and garlic powder and the Sephardi palate is cinnamon and allspice. And they never, like, you know, there's no crossover. And I think that recipe really, like, crossed over the different palates. And the Moroccans were, like, who hate gefilte fish. They're known for Sephardim hate gefilte fish. They were, like, interested. And so many people have made that recipe and, like, wow. And then Ashkenazi, who really like, you know, the kind of bland gefilte fish, were putting all these spices in it. And they were like, you know, this is amazing. So, you know, that kind of got me started on really playing with different gefilte fish recipes. So the one in Totally Kosher is has curry in it and peas and ginger and garlic and, a curried a dip. That's really delicious. So it's definitely out of the box. And I would definitely say for people that are terrified of gefilte fish, it's a great gateway.
The book is really fantastic. It's really smart and definitely adds to our repertoires for making a little change around the kosher table. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's Hani Applebaum. We've been preparing for Passover and discussing her latest book, Totally Kosher. You'll find a recipe for those curried gefilte fish patties on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Bay leaves. Do they actually do anything? What do they taste like? And why are they the internet's latest whipping post? We answer all the questions next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. We've all been there, rummaging through the spice rack for that jar of bay leaves, only to find them pale in color and dried out like crunchy foliage on a New England sidewalk. Are they still good to use in this desiccated state? Are they relevant at all to a recipe, even when fresh? Paula Forbes weighs in on the latest bay leaf dust-up in her piece for her Substack, Stained Page News. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
I love that you wrote about this.
I'm glad. I love bay leaves. I was actually a little bit surprised to see people calling them into question.
Yeah, so when did this latest bay leaf brouhaha resurface?
Yeah, so I think that this has always been kind of a question people have. What do bay leaves taste like? What do they do? You don't actually eat them. You take them out before the dish is served. But I think this most recent round started when Ina Garten did an interview with the New Yorker Radio Hour, where she talked about wondering how much difference bay leaves make. And since then, that was in December, and since then I've seen just jokes on TikTok, on Twitter. There was a New Yorker cartoon about it, and everyone's just calling bay leaves into question. So I wanted to defend them a little bit.
I love that you're Team Bay. Describe the flavor and aroma of a fresh bay leaf.
I described it as a sort of mixture of green tea and thyme. It has this vegetal quality, but also floral quality. I've also heard people say that it has like a little tinge of menthol to it. So it's this very bright green floral flavor and scent. A lot of the bay leaves qualities are fragrances, not necessarily a flavor.
So what do you think it brings to a recipe?
I think it brings a lot of depth. I think it layers flavors onto what already exists. That's why you see it in, you know, broths and stocks and soups and stews. It, you know, just really brings out the flavor that's already in your dish, but adds this layer of complexity, again, that is largely fragrance.
When you use them, do you try to use fresh leaves or do you use dry leaves? And do you think the dry leaves still have enough of what the fresh bring?
I use fresh. I live in Texas where we can actually grow bay laurel trees. So there's often, you know, you have a neighbor who has them or you grow them in your herb garden. I do think that you can use the dehydrated kind. You just have to make sure that they haven't gone completely stale. Half the jokes you see about bay leaves on the internet are about people who have these jars that are 3, 5, 10 years old sitting in their pantry. And those aren't going to taste like anything. But if you use dried bay leaves that haven't been around for that long, they should really lend a strong bay flavor to whatever you use them in.
You sorted through some cookbooks to find out what various authors had to say about the leaves. What insights were you able to make? Would you read us a couple of them?
There were a few funny ones that sort of touch on this idea that, you know, people aren't really sure what bay leaves do. The Joy of Cooking, the most recent edition, says, "Bay leaves may seem like a culinary Hail Mary, an ingredient thrown in for good luck and not much else. However, we argue that they add a wonderful, subtle, menthol-like note to soups, stews, stocks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." I thought that that was very funny. We have a lot of examples of people using them in cuisines around the world. Julie Sani writes about them in Classic Indian Cooking. We have The Arab Table by Mary Bisou. I'm probably mispronouncing her last name and I apologize. Writes about using them in Turkish cooking. And then, of course, Melissa Martin's Mosquito Supper Club talks about using them in Louisiana and cooking. And then finally, in The Spice Companion by Lero Lev Serkarts, he writes, "When you think of bay laurel, the images of Olympic medalists or ancient Roman emperors donning wreaths may come to mind. What we now mostly use for culinary purposes has been considered a symbol of peace, honor, and triumph since the time of the ancient Greeks who ascribed it to Apollo in their myths. So we have this dried leaf that we're using in cooking, and people are calling into question that at some point, you know, belonged to Apollo. So the bay leaf should not be overlooked, I think.
I love that. He's so marvelous. What are some pairings that you discovered work well with the ingredient? How do you like to use it?
Actually, in the course of talking about bay leaves in various locations on the internet, I got a response from Eric Kim, who is a recipe developer at the New York Times. And he sent me a Nigella Lawson recipe that is a roasted pork loin over a bed of bay leaves that I ended up making. And it was amazing. It just, the entire kitchen smelled intoxicating making it. And I appreciated that it was a slightly different use for bay leaves than you normally see. You know, normally you have one or two in a liquid-based cooking application, but this was a roast that was, you know, on the bed of bay leaves. So I thought that that was a really fun way to do it. But yeah, I normally just, you know, same as everyone else, toss them in a soup, toss them in a stew. They're amazing with pork. They're great with lamb. Lovely in a pot of beans. So I'm a little generous in my application of using bay leaves, I think.
This has been such a fun conversation. Thank you so much, Paula.
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me.
That is Paula Forbes from Stain Page News. What's your take on bay leaves? Follow our Instagram account, KCRW Good Food, and let us know if you're yeah or no on their importance. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Von Meter, Lori Kondurajan, and Gary Masiha. Up next on The Treatment, Elvis sits down with Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, songwriters of the new musical series Up Here on Hulu. Plus, the former stuntman and director of John Wick, Chapter 4, joins to discuss the final installment of the franchise. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.